Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Building the Ballot. I've got something a little bit different this time. I've got a guest I've never spoken to myself. I've shared some DMs with and had some good Twitter conversations with. And it is Not Gaetti on Twitter. That's your username, Not Gaetti. So I'm going to go ahead and say, welcome, Not Gaetti, to Building the Ballot.
Thank you so much, Adam. It's really a pleasure to be here. We've had a lot of good back and forth on Twitter. I appreciate the different angles that everyone in the baseball community comes at these discussions, especially about the Hall of Fame ballots from. Some people, you know, really who played with and against these players have very strong feelings. People who worked in the game for years, but then there's also this whole other generation of folks that have such a handle on data and, you know, things that really weren't considered a few decades ago that, you know, one of my main things on Twitter is tweeting these underrated men, right? And so to the credit of WAR and some of these data-driven things, a lot of that does kind of shed light on just how good some of these overlooked players were in the past. At the same time, as you know, I don't think WAR is kind of the be-all, end-all that we should judge these players by. So I'm very pumped to speak with you about this and, see where we're at on some of these candidates.
Yeah. I'll be honest. I don't have like a set agenda. I'm not exactly sure where this one is going to go. I'm glad that you brought up the underrated players because I've really enjoyed that series. So essentially, if you're not following Not Gaetti, which if you are, pause. If you are not, pause and go follow him. Because, you know, we do come at things from a different perspective sometimes. But what I love in your posts is you clearly just love the act of watching baseball unfold in front of you. And there are these players that did these things that went underrated. And you know, some of them line up with the analytics, some of them don't. And I just love when you bring up these players because we can think about, you know, the different types of players that have played in the past. Like you brought up Tom Bernanski the other day. And right. What I like to do is a lot of times I like to say, you know, at this age of Aaron Judge, Tom Bernanski had more home runs than Aaron Judge does at this point, even though Judge has like a 60 homer and a 50 homer season. And it's just a great opportunity to remember these players, either from an analytical perspective or not so much. It could go either way.
Yeah. And obviously one of the things we also do in our back and forth is cherry pick stats like that. You know, some of the comparisons are just ridiculous, but they're all really fun. And sometimes you uncover something that is really like legitimately super interesting. Obviously the Bernanski versus Judge thing is because Bernanski came up young and then mm-hmm. Judge didn't have his monster season until, you know, now. It's been great. Today's this morning was Dave Steeb. Mm. And the more I look, I mean, everybody knows about taking no hitters into the ninth and just these, he should have like five or six no hitters and like multiple perfect games. And that's the thing people remember about him is these near misses on no hitters. But one of the things that really shocked me was seeing that he never in his career finished in the top three in Cy Young voting. Mm-hmm. And for a guy who just, you ask any player from that era, it's like, was Dave Steeb filthy? 100% of people are going to say like, yes, like his slider was gross. He threw 260 innings a year. He wanted the ball every day, like tough competitor. So in the eyes of people who played with and against him, they're like, he's a Hall of Famer. Like he should be in Cooperstown. And yet if you go back and you look, he wasn't even like a super decorated player of his time, even though he's arguably the best pitcher of the 80s.
Mm-hmm. So, I was kind of curious where you stand on that. Cause a little bit more background. I talk to a lot of people about the Hall of Fame and quite frankly, it can feel a little bit like an echo chamber sometime because I'm talking to a lot of people that also look at WAR and, you know, some of us, you know, follow along with WAR at different levels. I like it, but I also like to make sure I dig into it and see where these numbers come from. You do come from things from a different perspective. Like you said, you know, you don't see WAR as the be all and end all, but I know you have, you know, used it as one of many yardsticks, so to speak. So like with Dave Steeb, there's a lot of argument over this whole pitcher of the 80s thing. Was it Jack Morris? Was it Dave Steeb? Was it somebody else? Where do you kind of come down on that?
I've heard people argue it both ways. I think Steeb at his peak maybe was more dominant, but you know, the great thing about like these legendary baseball players in the Hall of Fame is like they have different aspects of their careers that people seize on and that people remember. And being a postseason hero really helped Jack Morris. I mean, the thought of going 10 innings, right, in game seven these days, it's not even plausible, right? You think about this guy, it's like, what is he, Superman? He's going out to throw the 10th inning of game seven and they win it, right? Dave Steeb, meanwhile, you look at his postseason career, he had like, what, two starts and like one of them was really bad. And so it's like he played for a lot of bad teams. He played very early in the existence of the Blue Jays. They were a terrible team. And so that's why he doesn't have like the counting stats, the hundreds of wins, doesn't have like the postseason legend going. But if you look at his peak from, I don't know, 1980 to most of the decade of the 80s, just super, super dominant. Yeah. I don't know. And you know, I'm a counting stats guy. So he had not even 200 wins, I think.
Yeah, I think it was significantly below. 176 is in my head for some reason. Yeah, 176 and 137.
So, you know, I don't know if that, I don't think 176 wins necessarily means you should be a slam dunk for Cooperstown, but others would say like, hey, if you're like the best pitcher of the decade you played in, like we should talk about it.
Interesting. Yeah. Like, so let's back up and talk a little bit about Hall of Fame in general. Like a lot of people follow and consume the Hall of Fame in many different ways. What is your relationship with the Hall of Fame? Are you like excited about Hall of Fame discussions? Do you consider yourself a big hall guy, small hall guy, you know, that type of thing?
In terms of guys that should get in, I've gone back and forth in my day. In terms of my personal relationship with the Hall of Fame, I have been to visit several times. I love it. Every aspect of it, the museum, like the hall itself, just inspires such awe. I go in there, I look at the same old guys every time, right? I go, I look at Babe Ruth, I look at Josh Gibson, I look at these they're dudes, right? The legends of the game. I always go and look who the most recent guys are, right? Because we're in the time where now we vividly watched and remembered these careers. And you see Frank Thomas and you see like Jim Thome and you're like, man, I watched these guys hit 500 foot bombs and just like hit walk off homers and, you know, do everything right. And it's great being there. And then the museum component, you know, they've got all this memorabilia, all this cool stuff, cleats from Miggy's Triple Crown season and whatever else. It's like every time you turn around, there's some new, cool, really interesting, mind-blowing thing. And I think it's great. I just think it's one of the most amazing places. In terms of like voting, I've at different times been like a bigger hall guy and a smaller hall guy. I've been a, you know, stats, like who was the best performer guy. I've also been like a Mr. Sanctimony kind of guy. And, you know, I think, and I certainly, there are people that I care about deeply in my life who are on both sides of the spectrum, right? Who think if you took PEDs, you just shouldn't be eligible to get into the Hall of Fame. You cheated the game, the character clause, right? Integrity. What does it say that you're taking performance enhancing drugs? You know, what does that mean in terms of how you respect the game, how you respect your opponents, how you respect your teammates? And, you know, I think under the system we have now, flawed though it may be, this is all left to the writers. The writers have ultimate discretion to interpret the character clause how they see fit. And that's part of what leads to this whole mess. Now, it would be one thing if the sanctimony card worked and had 100% kept PED associated guys out of the hall, right? But it's not just, you know, Bonds and Clemens have been kept out. But there are guys with PED associations who are in. And so if you have PED associated guys who are in the Hall of Fame and have plaques hanging in Cooperstown, how do you still justify keeping Bonds and Clemens out? It's like whatever the rationale has been, hasn't been applied uniformly, hasn't really worked extremely well, because now you have guys who are on the inside and guys who are on the outside looking in. And in some cases, it's guys with better numbers are left out. I mean, Barry Bonds, inarguably one of the great hitters of all time. Just crazy numbers. How many Bonds tweets do I do, right? He's got more intentional walks than second and third place on the all-time list put together.
Wild.
I mean, it's just, if he didn't get his first intentional walk until he was 35 years old, he still would have retired as the all-time leader.
That's incredible.
Yeah. And before he touched PEDs, he was 400-400. Mm-hmm. And he remains the only 400-400 player in Major League history.
And that was that early in his career. Yeah.
It's out of control. And yet he's not in the Hall of Fame because, you know, guys will say he cheated, whatever. At this point, there are enough guys who are in the Hall of Fame who, you know, we'll never know for sure. A lot of people strongly believe that there are guys currently in the Hall who use PEDs. And so I've come around to a position where it's just like, if these guys are indispensable to telling the story of baseball and they put up the best numbers of their era, I'm probably going to vote for them. I'm particularly going to support, though, clean players and guys who I think have been overlooked. I know we were trying to do this before the era committee ballot. Mm-hmm. Fred McGriff is my favorite player of all time.
Yeah, and let's talk Fred McGriff. Yeah.
So he is, you know, I'm 35. I started paying attention closely to baseball in the mid 90s. And I don't know, maybe I watched a lot of like Braves on TBS or something, but I just remember seeing this guy and it's like, he was hitting cleanup every day. He was playing defense every day. He's just had that look about him, right? He's calm in the box. He's got this monster swing, the helicopter follow through. He's putting things in the upper deck and just everything about him, like looked like a leader. And I was like, this guy is just like so solid, right? Then 1998, we have the expansion. He goes to the Devil Rays. They're in the AL East. I'm originally from the New York area, watch a lot of Yankees games. And so you see some of these AL East teams on television a lot. And the early Devil Rays were terrible, right? Except for this one guy who's still hitting like Fred McGriff. Mm-hmm. And I was like, man, this, I followed the rest of his career very, very closely. My family went on a trip to Chicago, I think in 2003, the year he was on the Cubs. It's the only game I've ever been to at Wrigley. Got to see Fred McGriff hit a homer in person. We saw six bombs that day. It was McGriff, Moises Alou, Sammy Sosa, Mark Bellhorn, Corey Patterson, and visiting Jeff Bagwell. And so of all the games I could have gone to, that was a pretty good one. But
yeah, I guess so.
It was, I can't remember what number homer that was for his career, somewhere in the, you know, 400s. But I just, when he retired and 5 years later showed up on the writer's ballot, the thing that crushed me with how low his support was I felt like the writers were trying to have it both ways. They wanted to punish these PED guys, but didn't give any kind of credit to players that were pretty much undisputably clean. You know, they'd be like, Barry Bonds, we're not going to vote for you because you took steroids. But Fred McGriff, we're not going to vote for you because you didn't hit as many homers as Barry Bonds.
Right.
And that drove me crazy. And I was like, maybe next year, maybe they'll get all on the same page and be like, you know what? We have to like pick a strategy here. Are we going to put in the guy with the best numbers, or are we going to punish the cheaters and put in the guys that really were like models of consistency? And 10 years go by he never got 40% of the vote. He topped out at 39 and change.
Right.
And that was just, it was so crazy for me, right? Same batting average as Ken Griffey Jr., same home runs as Lou Gehrig. That it's not like he was a slacker. And I've tweeted endlessly, I've written articles. Anybody who would listen to me, I'd explain how, you know, the year of the strike, he was on pace to hit almost 50 home runs in 1994. He was having a career year. And without the strike, he finishes like 508, 510 homers. And those same writers would be like, oh, well, that's what a first ballot Hall of Famer does, is hit 500 home runs. And so even as a counting stat guy, though, I just think the writer's ballot really did him wrong. And when he came up on the ERA committee, the big difference is the 16 guys on the committee are like real baseball people. They're in it. Mm-hmm. With the BBWAA, a lot of them are good, right? We love our good baseball writers, but there are people with a Hall of Fame vote that maybe haven't covered baseball in decades. Guys that watch hockey games for a living, but still get to vote for the Baseball Hall of Fame. And so you see some really weird ballots. We saw that K-Rod only ballot recently.
Right.
Somebody who voted for Francisco Rodriguez and nobody else. I can't make head or tail out of that. But I said, McGriff has a great chance on an ERA committee ballot because these are guys who played alongside him, played against him, watched him. And he was elected unanimously. He went 16 for 16. And I think that's extremely validating. You know, didn't get 40% of the vote from the writers and then got 100% of the vote from the baseball folks.
Yeah, it was a very validating result for him, I'm sure. You never know how those, like Lee Smith got a unanimous election through the committee too. So it's always interesting to see how those are going to align. Now, I'm not going to sit here and pretend that I was one of the people saying Fred McGriff should absolutely be in the Hall of Fame, but I'm also not one of the people that was saying Fred McGriff is nowhere near a Hall of Famer. Like it's obviously somewhere in the middle with me. I was totally fine with him going in either way. I'm more of like the Larry Walker, Scott Rolen type, but still very happy for Fred McGriff.
Yeah. And listen, I think I would vote for Scott Rolen. I would have voted for Larry Walker. Larry Walker, just talk about a legitimate five-tool guy, right? Mm. He did things that in combination, nobody else did.
Right.
You know, if you look at somebody with at least X batting average, OBP, slugging, stolen bases, and home runs, it's like him and Willie Mays or something, right? You'll find people who topped him in each category, but not in the combination.
Right. Particularly like the war components too. It was one of those where he was one of those guys that did really well in every single war component. Sneaky good base runner, very good fielder. And I know that that 100 R bat and 100 R field list that I sent you a while back, that seemed to resonate a little bit.
The catchers.
Not only for the catchers, but for like, because Gary Carter was on it, but just the players in general. I think I originally sent that maybe it was Jesse Barfield was the underrated man or something like that, because he's one of the guys that's on the list.
Right. Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was when Barfield and Carter was when it came up, because Carter's the only catcher on the list.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, you got to be really good on both sides of the game to get on that list. And there's no bad players on it.
Right. That's, you know, Jesse Barfield was the lowest in total career war on that list, but that's also because he had a relatively short career. I mean, there's 32 players total. Right. So that's quite the list to be on.
And Jesse Barfield was a home run king in 86.
Yep.
And everybody remembers like the cannon from the warning track, just gunning guys down at the plate. I mean, they were all great players.
Now, going a little bit into your background, I know that you are, let me get the term right, are you a hitting guru? Is that what I should call you?
You can call me a hitting guru. Really a hitting guru.
tell me about your hitting background. And I know aspects of that dictate how much you appreciate guys like Fred McGriff or like even like a Wally Joyner, the quote unquote professional hitter type. I know that like that type.
So, I played baseball through high school. I did not play college ball. I'm 5'7" on a good day. And I was a first baseman all through high school, even at my height, which is funny. I was originally a third baseman most of my life growing up, and then got to high school. We had way too many third basemen. And I remember after the first practice, the coach was like, I need one of you guys to go out and buy a first base glove tonight and bring it tomorrow. And tomorrow you're learning how to play first base, because the only first baseman we had, 6'5" or whatever, and was also like a pitcher. So somebody had to play over there on the days that he pitched. I was the only person who volunteered. I was like, I'll do it, coach. I went out and I bought a first base glove that night. And man, there's so much to learn. Just the footwork, the hands, the where you have to be for cutoffs. I mean, it's just like, I think people really underestimate the difficulty of playing first base. There's a ton of involvement, and there's always a correct place for you to be on every single play, no matter where the ball is on the field. And so that was like challenging, but I really enjoyed working on it. And I've mostly been, after high school and college, I started playing slow pitch softball, which I've been doing now for like 15 years. So I've been playing first base for like 20 years, even though I'm like this, small dude. So I got to, work on my vertical and do a lot of splits, but I love picking balls out of the dirt and, all of that. But, my stick is what it is. I hit pretty good, but I'm not Aaron Judge.
Right. So does your hitting background dictate the types of players that you're kind of drawn to then?
Oh, for sure. Because I just don't hit enough bombs to identify with the Jose Canseco's going to the fifth deck at Sky Dome. I never hit a no doubter. I never hit one so far that I could bat flip. when I hit a ball over the fence, I'm as surprised as anybody else. And I'm running out of the box like it's going to be a triple, and then I'm like, oh, that went over. So, but listen, I'm satisfied by poking a line drive, the other way. And just, I like trying to do the little things as a hitter. I like driving in runs. I'm a huge RBI guy. RBI is one of my favorite stats because, and I know a lot of the analytics people say it doesn't matter. It's too like circumstantial. It depends on the quality of your teammates. You could have a Joe Carter year where you have like an OPS in the 600s, but you drive in 105 runs or whatever. And my answer is like, I understand that. And maybe, yeah, you're going to drive in more runs if you have more guys on base in front of you, but you still have to get it done. If you come to the plate and there's a runner on third with less than two outs, doesn't matter what you do as long as you get the run home. Like, you just have to do it. You have to change your approach in different counts. Like, you shouldn't be swinging the same with two strikes or in a full count as you do earlier in the count. If I have runners on base, I do usually swing more aggressively earlier in the count. I'm not like going up there trying to take pitches. I'm going up there trying to put the ball in play and get runs home. Mm-hmm. And so I always had like a lot of sac flies. That's the thing. You have to go up to the plate with a mindset that like, this guy needs to score and I have to find some way to make that happen. And so I see all these guys who just like these short, like non-competitive at bats. It kills me to watch these Joey Gallo at bats or these Josh Donaldson at bats or Dan Vogelbach. Like, he's got a low swing rate. He's really selective. That's really good. And it's like, okay, but he has, he never gets the run home. People are overjoyed when they draw a walk. And more often than not, they're like walking back to the dugout after four pitches. And it's like, that's not baseball to me. That's not getting the job done. So yeah, I love the professional hitters. I love the no batting gloves guys. What's more old school than, you know, Mark Grace or listen, I could talk about those guys all day, but yeah, I totally identify with the professional hitters who are like, yeah, we have a job to do and I'm not going to like do what the spreadsheet tells me, like take your A hack in every count and hope it goes over the fence, because we're probably not going to string three hits together off Max Scherzer. Like that can't be the mindset. It's too defensive. Mm-hmm. You have to just be aggressive in the count when you can. And, you know, you just have to make adjustments. If the guy can't find the strike zone, yeah, like take some pitches. But if they're around the strike zone and you have an opportunity to put your team ahead, you just have to take good cuts. But then when you get to two strikes, your job doesn't change. You still have this guy on third base. You just have to really make sure that you like put the ball somewhere that's helpful.
All right. So building on this, I'm trying to paint a picture here. So the ballot, the rest of the ballot that McGriff was on. So we had McGriff, who is professional hitter, one of your favorites of all time. We had Bonds, who we already talked about, is clearly over the line. Clemens, clearly over the line. We have Bell, who sounds like with the RBIs you were talking about, Bell, professional hitter in Don Mattingly. We have Dale Murphy, who I think is just one of those all-around guys like a Walker or a Roland. Was that ballot 8 Hall of Famers to you?
I mean, that's a tough question. It certainly didn't have anybody that would have offended me if they got in. Like Murphy had the back-to-back MVPs. He was sort of like Walker Light of the 80s, but I think his batting average was something like 265. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's really hard to comp him to Walker, who I think hit like 313.
Coors.
Yeah, right. I'm a big Helton guy. I think Helton right. should get in. So, but we'll get back to Coors. In terms of the era ballot, Bell is an interesting guy because his peak was super high. I can't imagine there was a scarier guy to face in the mid-90s. My favorite Bell stat is that he is still the only player ever with 50 doubles and 50 homers in the same season, and he did it in a strike year.
Like the strike year part is wild.
That blows my mind. He had 52 doubles and 50 home runs in 144 games in 1995, I believe. And I mean, that it's ludicrous. to put it some greatness in perspective, though, that 50-50 year Bell had, even in a short year, his slugging that season was the same as Babe Ruth's slugging lifetime.
I was going to say Bell didn't take a lot of walks, but of course that has nothing to do with the slugging percentage.
690 he slugged that year.
That's absolutely wild.
But then his, his health declined. He had like a hip condition, I think. And so who knows what his numbers would have looked like, but they might've wound up looking like Juan Gonzalez, who, you know, hasn't gotten Hall of Fame traction.
Right. Yeah, I think Bell was certainly better than Juan Gonzalez when you end up looking at him through a little bit more of the analytical modern lens. But, Gonzalez was another that got a lot of RBIs and got those back-to-back MVPs, but just does not have the traction that even Bell has. I mean, it's the third time Bell's appeared on a ballot and Gonzalez right. hasn't appeared on any.
Mm-hmm.
So then
at their time, they were both super dominant and I just don't know where you draw the line for between like, here's a back-to-back MVP winner who drives in a ton of runs and here's who's in the Hall of Fame. Like it's gotta be right around there someplace, you would think.
Right. Yeah. There's not too many multi MVP guys on the outside. I think we've talked about four out of the five. Cause obviously Bonds is one, Murphy is who I meant to say, and then Gonzalez, and then of course Roger Maris is one, but
right,
he wasn't up this time around. So this BBWAA ballot, what would be the first check mark among all of the candidates that you would put down?
Well, again, as I said, I've gone back and forth between guys who have the numbers and, not feeling sympathetic towards guys who use PEDs. So I think now that my, 20 years of McGriff Hall of Fame advocacy or whatever are behind me, I'm feeling really strongly about advocating for Helton and Andrew Jones. And sort of comes back to, I think, something I mentioned about Walker earlier is like these are guys who did things that nobody else in their era did. Jones, arguably, the greatest defensive center fielder ever, certainly in the top handful. He could play center field shallower than anybody because he was so good at going back on the ball. Most other guys by necessity had to play a lot deeper. So they're giving up a lot more hits in front of them. And even if you think of him as like maybe he's a glove first guy because he's one of the best ever at his position. Well, he also had 434 home runs. Like, imagine if Ozzie Smith hit 400 home runs. He's already a Hall of Famer because he was great. I mean, for a guy with no power, he could hit okay, but he's there for his glove, and everybody knows that. You ask anybody, "Hey, is Ozzie Smith a Hall of Famer?" They say, "Sure," like one of the greatest at his position ever. Well, Jones has that going for him too, and also hit 434 home runs. So I feel like if you're one of the greats to ever play your position, and you also have like some healthy offense, you probably should get in.
I think that under Jones, a lot of ink has been spilled over the way his career ended. And the 2008 season with the Dodgers, it was 75 games, and it was basically some of the worst 75 games a player ever played. There's no denying that. But then the four partial seasons he played after that, a lot of people say that he was done. But in basically half seasons each time, he hit 17, 19, 13, 14 home runs. He has OPS plus. I don't know if how OPS plus is kind of advanced, but not all that advanced, just taking the OPS and comparing to league average and park adjusting. 108, it was above average for a player. It's like, and people act like he was this completely useless player for the last 4 years of his career. He certainly was in one of those years, but in the others, he was not. And it's interesting how that narrative has just perpetuated. But I mean, it still helped him get past 60 WAR. Yes, his career did end earlier than many do, but still, he played till he was 35. I'm on board with Andrew Jones. I'm on board with Todd Helton. I'm right there with you. My first check mark is probably Scott Rolen, just because I feel like he's got the all-around game and he's so clean. There's like no questions about his sometimes things go beyond PEDs. Both Helton and Andrew Jones have other things in their past. Thank goodness I've never heard anything about Scott Rolen, so I can always feel good about that check mark. Not that I have a vote, but
Yeah, and I think everybody remembers him as like a really outstanding third baseman. I think people forget what a great hitter he was. He had a ton of extra base hits. Like he hit for power year in and year out, legitimately. He was a run producer, but he was also a great third baseman. I mean, he's kind of in the mold of like Adrian Beltre in terms
Just,
of
yeah.
both sides.
Right. In that respect, he certainly did not have the longevity of an Adrian Beltre.
No.
Not many people did. There's these guys that are sneaky good hitters. I think Jim Edmonds was another one. Like, everybody's like, oh, he's, eight-time Gold Glover, but he also had an OPS for his career above 900. Like, it's ridiculous.
And the list of guys with 900 OPSs who are not in the Hall of Fame is like pretty short. And the ones who aren't in definitely come up in the underrated man tweets. Brian Giles, right? I think his
Right.
is over 900. Lance
Isn't
Berkman.
Yeah, Lance Berkman was kind of, oh my God, Brian Giles was over 900. You're right.
Right?
Holy.
That man was underrated.
He certainly was, yeah.
And yet, I think we're kidding ourselves if we say, like, Giles for Hall of Fame.
I think Berkman has a better shout. You know, my thing when Fred McGriff went in was, I like Fred McGriff. I'm happy he got in, but I don't know where Fred McGriff is ahead of Lance Berkman, or maybe he's just a little bit ahead of this guy. But Carlos Delgado, another one.
I love Carlos Delgado.
I have a hard time figuring out where to draw that line.
I think Carlos Delgado should be in the Hall of Fame. I think they both should be in the Hall of Fame. And I thought that when they were both on the BBWA ballot, for sure.
All right. Well,
Berkman's interesting because he was a, you know, switch hitting center fielder for a while. Mm-hmm. Who was hitting, you know, 50 doubles a year, had a bunch of homers, run producer. Just tremendous, tremendous. And to get that from the center field position is always something special. But yeah, his OPS is like 940 or something.
943.
It's crazy. So yeah, he was for sure underrated.
So I think we're establishing we're kind of big haul here because we've got a lot of people going in. That's okay. So and
I think that'll happen if you just love baseball, because you wind up coming across so many players and you're like, this guy is awesome.
Thank you. Like, a lot of people, I don't understand the people who are like, there's no way that Todd Helton is a Hall of Famer. And you know, why would you take that stand? Why is it so awful to celebrate more baseball players, especially when in the 1930s, you know, they were putting everybody in. So why can't we put, you know, really good ball players like Carlos mm-hmm. Delgado in the Hall of Fame? But no, it's got to be this hemming and hawing of upholding this standard, which is actually the highest it's ever been.
And the funny thing is, like, you know, I talk to a lot of big leaguers through Twitter and whatever else, and man, I know big leaguers who say Todd Helton's the best hitter they ever saw play. And it means a lot coming from guys who spent time in the show and watched this happen. Helton had back-to-back seasons of 400 total bases. Do you know how few times that's ever happened? It's like Lou Gehrig, I'm sure, has done it, but not recently.
Before him, wasn't it Jim Rice or something like that?
I don't know if Jim Rice had two back-to-back.
Not back-to-back. I think he had one in 78.
Oh, yeah. No, the 400 total base season is a rarity. Four guys did it in 2001, and nobody's done it since.
Got it. Okay.
Sosa, Luis Gonzalez, Barry Bonds, and Helton all did it the same year, and nobody's done it in over two decades now. But Helton did it 2 years in a row, which those other guys didn't. And that's crazy to think about. He had 59 doubles 1 year. Guys don't just do. And I know people are tempted to be like, oh, Coors, whatever. Helton's road OPS was higher than Tony Gwynn's career OPS.
Yeah, I was posting about his during his prime decade, his I think his OPS was like second in the league or something behind Bonds or whatever, mm-hmm. but his road OPS would have been like 13th or something like that. I mean, he was just a really, really good hitter no matter where he played. It was same thing with Larry Walker. Like mm-hmm. people, you know, went bananas over his, you know, OPS because of course, but failed to realize that he only played like 30% of his career games in Coors. Like,
yeah,
that's it.
And Walker and Helton, both multiple gold glovers.
Right.
And guess what? Playing defense at Coors is probably no treat because everyone's mashing.
Right.
So it's like you have to give these guys credit for just what tremendous all-around players they were.
So as much as I love hitters, and this kind of builds on something you mentioned earlier where like they wouldn't vote for the steroid guys, but they also wouldn't vote for the guys who were not putting up the numbers of the steroid guys who were supposedly clean. A lot of modern pitchers are also getting ignored. Like, let's take a guy who I think we probably both like, Mark Burley, you know, a 3.80 ERA. So no way he can be a Hall of Famer. Well, you know, that's because somebody had to pitch to these guys, right?
Right.
You know, he's thrown 200 innings every year. And when I say that, I mean, literally every year. He, you know, I don't know. I think that pitchers like Mark Burley, like Tim Hudson, I almost said Tom Glavine. What am I talking about? Tim Hudson, even Andy Pettitte, who, you know, I don't love because of, you know, he was a Yankee, but I'll get over it. But, you know, guys like this are just, there aren't many anymore. And I think that as their careers become further in the distance, we're going to realize that, actually those guys might've been Hall of Famers. You know, Roy Oswalt might be another one too.
Yeah, he was good. I mean, Burley there's something to be said for being a guy who answers the call every 5 days for his whole career and just eats the innings and keeps your team in it and gives you a chance to win. There are so many guys today that are absolutely lights out for 4 1/3. But these guys who give you 200 innings a year, and it's like, when you have a guy like that pitching, the hitters feel good. They're like, okay, like, let's go score some runs, because like, Mark's going to get a lot of ground balls. Like, we're going to have a chance. We're going to have a chance to win this one, because he's going to give us 7 innings, and like, we just got to score some runs. And it's like, that's kind of an intangible, like, I don't know how WAR captures the way having a certain guy on the mound makes you feel, right? But Nolan Ryan's teammates knew not to talk to him on the game days that he was pitching, but they had to be like, hey, we got Nolan on the hill today, and he's going to strike out 18 guys, and I think we got a chance. You know, I don't know how you quantify that, but, you know, today there's so many guys that are just made of glass, and they're going to go 135 innings a season, and it's unpredictable, and he's going to skip a start with this, and he's got to be on a 6-day rotation, and, you know, it's like, come on. So the old school types, I really respect the career that Mark Burley had. I don't know if he's a Hall of Famer, but he's certainly the kind of pitcher that I really like.
I like him too. I'm also going to change my focus to Tim Hudson here. And, you know, as much as I love Billy Wagner, I don't understand how Billy Wagner is getting all of these votes because of 903 innings, when Tim Hudson had over 3,000 innings of like 3.5 ERA ball with I know it's not cool to mention it anymore, but a ridiculously good winning percentage. And, you know, how did he get so ignored? Because he looks like the perfect traditional candidate pitcher, but I don't know, maybe just like, he didn't win 300, so that doesn't happen anymore. The fact that he got bounced off the ballot so quickly, like, I definitely think Tim Hudson is a Hall of Fame pitcher.
I definitely think Tim Hudson was underrated, and
he was a recent underrated man. That's right.
He was. I don't know if I'd go so far as to say I definitely think he's a Hall of Famer. I think he's much closer to 200 wins than 300, which, you know, sometimes you just hope a guy who pitched as long as he did comes out a little better in the counting stats, especially for somebody who won such a high percentage of his starts. And Billy Wagner, I think the 900 innings or whatever has always been my biggest misgiving about his career, because otherwise, as dominant as any closer ever. And I guess you have to take a little bit of solace in the fact that even if he didn't throw a ton of innings, every single one was a high leverage inning pretty much. Mm-hmm. And he also went out on top. He had one of his very best seasons ever at the very end. I think he had 38 saves and an ERA in the ones or something.
Yeah, I'm not saying that Billy Wagner's not a Hall of Famer, but there are definitely starting pitchers I would put in before him. And if relief pitchers are Hall of Famers, which they are, Billy Wagner's got to be one, because I feel like he's by far the best one that's outside. and, you know, maybe even second to Mariano Rivera.
Yeah, I would take that. I would agree with that assessment.
So who are the pitchers then? Like, we get a lot of hitters that we've talked about as Hall of Famers, but not very many pitchers. Are there pitchers outside the Hall of Fame that should be in, or are pitchers just not worth anything and not Hall of Famers?
I'm biased as a position player, right? You know, obviously Clemens, he's the bonds of pitching, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know where different people come down on him. He certainly
is Burley the McGriff. He's getting overlooked because Clemens is.
Yeah. Right. Mark Burley. We're not voting for Clemens because he did PEDs. We're not voting for Burley because he wasn't as good as Clemens.
Right.
Yeah, totally. I think that's a great comparison for sure. I always thought Tommy John should be in because, you know, there's also like this notion of fame. And in addition to being a very good pitcher, he also is the namesake of this surgery that now preserves how many careers? People get it multiple times. People get it earlier than ever. There are guys who would never pitch another game in their life but for Tommy John surgery. And his story is amazing coming back from it and still being an effective pitcher. And he was close to 300 wins. And I mean, he's a household name, right? Anybody that's ever had an elbow injury knows the name.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not like it's just a gimmick, but he also was a very good prolific pitcher for a long time.
Right. I think with Tommy John, I agree somewhat on the fame thing. It is called the Hall of Fame, but yes, I don't want to go too far on the side of, you know, just letting anyone that was famous for a little while get in. But I do subscribe to the point of, you know, needing to be able to tell the story of baseball, you know, with certain people. And I think Tommy John is one of those. I think he's a pioneer as well as a, honestly, now probably an overlooked player. I think people talk more about how he lasted a long time. They talk about the surgery and they don't talk about how he was a well above average pitcher for 4,700 innings and 700 starts.
Right.
Like that's hard to do.
Mm-hmm. I think Louis Tiant is a Hall of Famer. I think he was dominant. He was just a competitor. He was an incredible pitcher. Anybody who saw him pitch, you know, would tell you that he was great. I had the privilege of attending the New York State Baseball Hall of Fame induction last month. And Louis was one of the inductees, and Bucky Dent and a couple of other guys were inducted as well. And it was really, really powerful that every inductee took a little bit of time when they got up there to say, Louis Tiant, you deserve a plaque in Cooperstown.
Mm.
And hearing that from guys who were teammates of his, guys who were opponents of his, you know, it, as I said before with the ERA committee ballot, hearing from the guys who saw you do it day in and day out, what they think, if they think you're a Hall of Famer. And it was just really, really a neat experience. And if you look at his numbers, they're tremendous.
But both he and Tommy John did not pitch to hitters of the steroid era, which brings me back to my overlooked steroid era pitchers, or have enough pitchers gotten in? We went, you know, 11 years or whatever in between Nolan Ryan in 1999 and Burt Blyleven in 2011 getting in, which created a long gem of pitchers. And it's Tommy John and Louis Tiant that were impacted by that, as well as some others. And then, you know, we have gotten quite a few modern pitchers. You've got Pedro, we got Randy Johnson, we got Glavin, we got Smoltz, Mussina. I'm sure there's a couple others I'm thinking of. Is that all? Like, I feel like there should be some others if there are a lot more hitters that we're looking at. But I don't know. Maybe I'm too sympathetic to the pitchers, but I might be onto something here.
Yeah, I mean, I think statistically arguments could be made for Curt Schilling. He's got his own, you know, separate issues.
Mm.
Statistically, as a pitcher, he did some remarkable things. He had 300 strikeout seasons. He had a year with 15 complete games. Like, guys don't do that anymore.
Yeah, I put him in with Bonds and Clemens as guys who clearly would have been Hall of Famers if not for other things, so to speak.
Sure. Yeah. I'm with you. And then Pettit is on the ballot. Mm-hmm. His, you know, growing up in New York, I saw him pitch a lot, and he just had so many opportunities in the postseason. Just the number of postseason wins, postseason innings, he was there year in and year out, and you know, playing in the biggest market in the world. So he certainly got a lot of exposure. His numbers are very good. I would not be offended if he got in, but I can also see people saying like he was not the greatest pitcher of his era. And so I mean, I could go both ways on him. I'm not going to flip out if he gets in or doesn't. And so I think be surprised. I'd be more surprised if he got in than if he didn't, but I'd be okay with it either way.
What's interesting about Pettit is he and Burley, aside from some extra wins because of being on the Yankees, they're the same pitcher. Like their innings total, their ERA, they're the same. Their ERA plus is literally exactly the same. Their WAR, I think, is less than one apart. So between like the two of them and then Tim Hudson and, you know, Roy Oswalt, maybe we can talk about Johan Santana as well. Maybe it's just that there's several that are in the conversation and nobody stands out. So it's hard to put one in without all of them. I don't know. Is that
and,
it?
And you can't justify putting all of them in.
I think maybe you could, but you know, maybe in that case you lean towards a guy like Johan Santana who had the shorter burst of stardom.
Yeah, but what a peak.
Oh yeah.
He was incredible.
I'd put him in front of the other four, to be completely honest.
Yeah, at his peak, he was more dominant and a better pitcher than them.
Yep.
You know who we haven't talked about? Jeff Kent.
I was just going to say, we haven't talked about Jeff Kent. That's a professional hitter right there, isn't it?
Yeah. He is the only player in baseball history to have the most home runs at his position and not either be in the Hall of Fame or out for steroids.
You know what I expect to happen with Jeff Kent?
What?
I expect him to get the Fred McGriff treatment on the era committee ballot. I think when he comes in, he's going to go in the first time.
That would not surprise me. He had, I think, like 560 doubles, 377 homers. Being able to get that kind of production from a second baseman is special, because most teams do not have a second baseman that hits like a first baseman.
Right.
And, you know, he won an MVP. He had some big numbers. I think he probably gets dinged a little bit for defense. He's by, you know, not like a super defensive middle infielder by any stretch, but more than makes up for it with the bat, because he played in an era still where middle infielders, as a general rule, did not hit like Alex Rodriguez. That was just starting to happen. And now I think you see middle infielders are getting bigger and stronger, banning takeout slides and stuff like that, right? Now, these days, Mike Moustakas, you're a second baseman. Like, the game has changed a little bit. But yeah, when Kent was playing, just ridiculous to have a guy who hits like that. And that's something that always struck me, is just if you have the most home runs at your position in baseball, you're in the Hall of Fame, or you're being kept out because you cheated. And he's the only one who's neither of those.
Yeah, it's a good point. I have him above my line. I felt similarly about him as I did with McGriff. Like, I think that, I am totally good with him going in, but I didn't have him near the top of my list. I do have him higher than McGriff, to be honest. I'm a little surprised at how little support he's gotten, but it's year 10 now. And I think that he'll have a very quick time on the era committee ballots. Cause although I don't know, he wasn't well loved from what I understand in the clubhouse. So maybe he does run into some issues there.
Yeah, and not just in the clubhouse, but certainly with the media. Whereas, you know, think about a guy like David Ortiz, just so gregarious and mm-hmm. just like fun. And who doesn't like David Ortiz, right? So you see the support that he got. If Jeff Kent had the personality of a David Ortiz, is he already in many years ago?
If Jeff Kent had David Ortiz, oh yeah.
Yeah, right. Oh, yeah. I mean, so I don't know. I feel like you have to try to be more objective and not just be like, that guy's a jerk, I'm not going to vote for him. And yet it happens all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the objectivity can work different ways in Hall of Fame voting, it seems. Kind of like, you know, there's the whole narrative of the character clause, you know, only, you know, dings people rather than, you know, helps, you know, a Dale Murphy or something like that. Although right. I think we saw the character clause actually work for David Ortiz. You know, in many cases, it's hard to tell the story of baseball without David Ortiz, you know, the postseason heroics and everything. But he definitely benefited from his gregarious nature when it comes to the old, you know, pre-testing report that, you know, leaked and all of that. But
yeah, I mean, if you're a writer and you're looking at your ballot and you're going down and you see David Ortiz, you go, you know what? I really like that guy. He always made me feel good. I always liked covering him. I always liked talking to him. I'm going to vote for him. You get to Jeff Kent. You're like, that guy blew me off, you know, didn't treat me well. I just don't think he gets my vote. And it probably has an impact on some of these writers.
I know. It makes me wonder if who gets in first, Jeff Kent or Dustin Pedroia.
Dustin Pedroia is an interesting case.
I think the numbers probably fall a little short, but he definitely has hardware and he was definitely loved. So he might benefit from some of that. Maybe like a Kirby Puckett type case where right. the total numbers weren't quite there.
Totally. I could see that happening.
Cool. So should I force you to pick 10 names for your ballot?
I want to say I may have already.
Or maybe you don't use all 10. I don't want to assume here.
I definitely did. I filled out a ballot and tweeted it at some point. I'd have to go find it. But I think I'm a Bobby Abreu guy also.
Interesting, because we had a good conversation about Bobby Abreu on Twitter compared to Vlad Guerrero, because somebody in the replies was yes. railing against Bobby Abreu railing against WAR because it says Bobby Abreu is better than Vlad Guerrero, which it's like less than one win above replacement difference. They're in a dead heat. Don't use WAR to the single decimal point to say that a player is better than another when you're talking about 20 years of stats. I think everybody knows that. Well, right. Most people know that. But yeah, they went about things very differently.
And what we came across was that Abreu just did things that like weren't sexy, right? Mm-hmm. Vlad could hit a double on a pitch that bounced. Bobby's taking that pitch because he's on his way to 120 walks that season. And I think if you look at the combination of something like 100 ribbies, 100 walks, and like 20 stolen bases or something, Abreu's like the all-time leader in seasons like that. He had 400 stolen bases.
I know. That's one that surprises everybody every time because he looked like a big dude.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, so here, I just found my ballot.
Oh, cool.
And I did use all of the votes. And here's who I voted for. Bobby Abreu, Todd Helton, Andrew Jones, Jeff Kent, Andy Pettit, Manny Ramirez, Alex Rodriguez, Scott Rolen, Gary Sheffield,
and Billy Wagner. Hitter Gary Sheffield, yeah. Mm-hmm. All right, I like that a lot. Those are 10 players that I would support. Ooh, there is a very glaring omission, though. I'm trying to see like who's not on there. So you're no on Carlos Beltran?
Because of the sign stealing. He will get my vote next year when Kent is off the ballot.
Got it. Okay.
I will vote for Carlos Beltran, just not this year.
So I had 12 that I wanted to vote for. Or if I had a vote, I definitely do not have a vote. So
I'm not even Gaetti. I don't get a vote.
My tiebreaker, or not tiebreaker, but my way of picking two names that I had to remove is the post-testing positive tests. So I actually would, if I had a ballot, I would leave off Manny and A-Rod. Mm-hmm. And I would do all the same players that you did, except I would put on Beltran and Burley.
And I do not begrudge anybody for not voting for Manny or A-Rod. I voted a strictly stats ballot. A-Rod was suspended for an entire season. Manny was suspended multiple times. If you think that cheaters have no place in the game, you should not vote for those guys.
I would only not vote for them just because of the ballot crunch. If, mm-hmm. you know, people are cleared out, you know, I would certainly vote for them in the future if I had a vote.
Totally. I think that is a very like valid demarcation. That's something that I support you using as a tiebreaker. And I totally get it. If people say, I'm not going to vote for these guys who were suspended, mm-hmm. especially multiple times. Incidentally, Manny and A-Rod probably have two of my favorite right-handed swings ever. I think for, you know, lefties, every lefty has like a beautiful swing. for righties, I'm big on A-Rod, Manny, Mark McGwire, and Albert Pujols.
Sheffield's probably in there too, right?
Sheffield's got to be in there too. Yeah. Just that they could really smoke the ball, but I mean, Manny's numbers are ridiculous. A-Rod's numbers are ridiculous. A-Rod had the 40-40 year. Manny just super high batting average, super high home runs, super high RBI. But, you know, suspended multiple times. So it's hard. It's hard. As somebody who, I mean, I like playing fair. I don't cheat at stuff. It's just it would make me feel gross, mm-hmm. personally. So I wrestle with voting for these guys, but as I said before, I think enough people with like PED associations are already in that I just kind of have to throw up my hands a little bit and be like, these guys were the best of their day. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's how I came up with my ballot.
Yeah, I definitely get that. And then looking ahead to 2024, where you said you would use the Kent spot on Beltran. I do want to point out we do have Adrian Beltre coming on the ballot. We have three more interesting candidates in, kind of curious to get your thoughts on Chase Utley, Joe Mauer, and David Wright, all kind of like somewhat shorter, but also for a time certainly among the best players at their positions in the game.
And Mauer and Wright are, you know, single franchise homegrown guys that just their fans love them. I was a big David Wright guy. I thought so many players I just wish had perfect health, yep. and played for a long time, because what would David Wright's career look like with longevity?
Yeah.
Or what would, Mauer's career look like if they had made him a first baseman before he got really banged up and still hit like Joe Mauer of old, but right. just at a safer spot? He was already the only catcher to win multiple batting titles, I think. And then he won a third one, I believe.
Yeah. Was he the first since Lombardi to even win one at all? Or did Lombardi get two? Let's see. Lombardi got two. So he was the first since Lombardi to get multiple batting titles.
And I think the only one with three.
Yeah, Lombardi only had the two.
It's crazy. And he could run well. He was a good defender. But I mean, Mauer and Buster Posey, the catchers have shorter careers, even the ones, well, some do. We talked about Gary Carter. He was underrated because he was effective for a long time on both sides of the ball. These guys who just, I get that catchers break down. I'm really interested to see kind of how voters treat Mauer, Posey, and Yadier Molina. It's going to be interesting because I don't think any of them are like, you'd be stupid to vote for them or you'd be stupid to not vote for them. It's going to be somewhere in the middle. And I just, I don't know. That's going to be very interesting. But Adrian Beltre certainly would get my vote. In fact, at the time of Fred McGriff's retirement, I declared Adrian Beltre as my favorite active player. And then at the time of Beltre's retirement, I declared Freddie Freeman my favorite active player. And then I allowed Aaron Judge to move into a tie. So I'm a Freeman and Judge guy at the moment.
I think I remember publicly declaring Beltre as my favorite active player at one point as well. So he's easy to love.
Yeah, he was fun and he was great. And when you're both, what's not to like?
Exactly. Yeah, for those catchers, like that's going to be really interesting because Molina and Posey slash Mauer are all very different. And honestly, I love catchers. I think they're underrated. I would put all three of them in a heartbeat. That would save a lot of the hemming and hawing over it, but there's going to be a lot of that to follow, which will be interesting. And I'll just sit here from the sidelines saying, why not all?
Yeah, right. Catchers are a different breed. They're tough. Yeah. And I mean, it's a hard job. It's an important job. And if you're a catcher that can also hit, that was always looked at as just a bonus. Like you're getting away with something if you have a catcher that also can hit. And Posey won a batting title and an MVP.
Mm-hmm.
Yadi was not the hitter that the other guys were, but tremendous catch and throw guy. And he could hit too. And he had the longevity. He played a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But worked really well with pitchers, could throw guys out, you know, for a long time. Yeah, if they all wound up in the Hall of Fame, I would not be shocked.
Yep. And I won't make you keep going into the next year, which is Dustin Pedroia, but also Ichiro and CC Sabathia. Those are three more great candidates as well.
Ichiro, I think, should be unanimous.
Yeah, I would be surprised if he's not. I think he has a very good chance of becoming the first position player to be unanimous, unless Beltre beats him to it. I mean, Beltre has no flaw. Like, nope. There's no reason not to vote for. Although, you know, Ken Griffey Jr. had no flaw either, and somebody dared not to vote for him too. So,
and that's another thing. You know, I look back at some of these Hall of Fame records and just, you know, like 40 guys leaving Frank Robinson off the ballot, or it blows my mind. Mm-hmm. Nine people not voting for Hank Aaron. It makes you so mad.
As bad as some folks think Hall of Fame voting is today, it is so much better than it was. And, you know, honestly, like sometimes I wonder, like, should they improve the process or is it perfect? Because it leads to all of this conversation. We're sitting here recording a podcast on a Monday night because we have nothing better to do than talk about the Hall of Fame. And that's the best. I mean, I love that it allows us to, you know, have these players. You know, I don't like talking about PEDs over and over again, but boy, do I love talking about, you know, Scott Rolen and Adrian Beltre and players like that.
Right. Because there's no good answer to the PED discussion. Like, we wish everybody was super clean or, you know, that the playing field was level somehow. But for these guys who don't have like flaws, it's great just being able to debate on the merits. Like, do you think if you've stood in the Hall of Fame and you looked at these plaques and you think about some of these guys and you ask yourself, do they belong in this room? It's a much different experience than like sitting at my keyboard being like, let me look at this guy's stats and make up my mind, like from my armchair over here. Right. You're like Hank Aaron's plaque is looking at you and you're like, okay, so does A-Rod belong like on the wall in the same room? And you're like, what? He was suspended for a year. You know, it's like, yeah, he hit 696 homers or whatever, but it's just like all these thoughts go through your head. And when I'm there, I feel like I just have so much more like respect for the guys who don't have the taint in the associations with PEDs and stuff. I don't know. It's weird. It's hard to explain.
Yeah, I can see that. Well, to bring it full circle too, though, I also appreciate that you have started this Man is Underrated series, because I think it's important to also have a place to talk about some of these players in a non-Hall of Fame centric way, because, you know, I want to talk about, you know, Kevin McReynolds or Placido Polanco as being underrated players without having to, you know, defend their Hall of Fame cases, which they don't have. Well, I don't know. Totally. Maybe Polanco is a little closer than some might admit, but I'm glad that we're able to have chats like this about all these different types of players. And I appreciate that. So thank you.
Yeah, of course. It's my pleasure. I tweet an underrated man every single day at 8 a.m. Eastern. And I think I would get a much different reaction if I tweeted like Mark Grace for Hall of Fame versus Mark Grace is underrated. Mm-hmm. And I like being able to celebrate some of these guys who, you know, did important things. Mark Grace had the most hits of the 90s, the most doubles of the 90s. He was the guy that hit behind Sosa the first two seasons. Sosa hit over 60 home runs. He was a good first baseman. He was a no batting gloves guy. He was old school. He didn't go to the gym. He never lifted weights in his life. And he had a great career and hit for high average and, you know, did all these professional hitter stuff. I'm not saying I don't want to have an argument with somebody over whether Mark Grace is a Hall of Famer, but mm-hmm. I feel like we can all get on the same page about, oh yeah, remember him? Like, he was awesome, and not enough people talk about how awesome he was.
I love it. I love it. So many guys I'm ready to chat about when you get to that point.
Oh, totally. And I always appreciate your participation. And when you bring some interesting statistical comps and lists and everything to the discussion, people love that.
Like Placido Polanco being the all-time record holder in career fielding percentage at second base and third base.
Right? Mind blown.
All right. Well, Mr. Not Gaetti, I really appreciate you taking the time to chat. I've taken quite a bit of your night, and I want to thank you for this discussion. A little different than what I usually do here, but I really enjoyed it.
Well, it's been absolutely my pleasure. I'm happy to come back and do it anytime, because I just love talking ball.
Yeah, this is fun. All right, you have a good one.
You too. Thanks, Adam.
Thanks.